Our scripture this morning is from 1 Kings chapter 11, beginning with verse number 9. Solomon is the king of Israel at this time. The Lord was angry with Solomon because Solomon had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel. God had appeared to him twice, had commanded him concerning the matter of the covenant that Solomon should not follow other gods, but Solomon did not observe what the Lord commanded. Therefore, the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your mind, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. Now, for the sake of your father David, I'll not do it in your lifetime. I'll tear it out of the hand of your son. I will not, however, tear away the entire kingdom. I'll give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. The Lord always blesses the reading of the Holy Scripture. Well, this week we're going to talk about the book of 1 Kings, and next week we're going to talk about the book of 2 Kings. You may wonder why we have 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Chronicles. When these books were originally written in the ancient Hebrew, they were just one book. There was just the book of Samuel and just the book of Kings and just the book of Chronicles. But about 200 years before Jesus was born, much of the Old Testament was translated into Greek because that was the main language people were speaking at that time. And when you rewrite the Hebrew into the Greek, it takes up more space. And so the scrolls were such that they decided that they would split the book of Samuel, and they would split the book of Kings, and they would split the book of Chronicles. So that's what we have now from the Old Testament. It probably should be the Book of Kings Part 1 that we should be calling this, but anyway, we call it 1 Kings. The 1 Kings is a story that takes place in ancient Israel, and it begins at the time that King David is dying, and it covers the period of the struggle as to who's going to be the next king after David dies, which of his sons is going to get the job. And then, of course, Solomon is the one who gets the job, and the book of 1 Kings covers the period of Solomon's life and Solomon's kingship. It includes a long section about how Solomon built the temple and how he decorated it and all of that sort of thing. Solomon will die in the book of 1 Kings, and then he will be succeeded by other kings. When Solomon dies, there is a civil war in the kingdom of Israel, and the kingdom splits into two parts, the northern part and the southern part, just like we had a civil war in our own country between the north and the south. Except in the biblical story, the two sides never get back together. They never again form a unified Israel. The 10 tribes in the north continue to call themselves Israel. The 2 tribes in the south will, from this point in the Bible on, be known as the nation of Judah. So that civil war occurs in the book of 1 Kings, and we see kings in the north, we see kings in the south. The three main characters in the book of 1 Kings are Solomon, whom I already said something about, and Ahab, who is going to be a king in the northern kingdom, and Elijah, who is the prophet who takes on King Ahab. Those are the three main characters in 1 Kings, Solomon, Ahab, and Elijah. As the book of 1 Kings opens, the question is, who is going to succeed King David? He's gotten to be old, he's about ready to die, and it's clear that somebody's going to have to be king after him. The two logical choices were his oldest sons, Amnon and Absalom, but they got killed off in the book before because of family conflicts and violence. And so the two logical choices to be king aren't there anymore. And the only two plausible choices are either Adonijah or Solomon. And which will it be? Adonijah the older or Solomon the younger? Well, Solomon's famous mother, Bathsheba, does some lobbying with the old dying king, and so he chooses Solomon to be the successor. So Solomon is one of those figures in history who provokes a great deal of controversy. There are people who thought that Solomon was the greatest, the richest, the most romantic, the most splendid, the best king that Israel ever had. And Solomon was one who thought that way. He thought himself that he was the greatest that ever had been. There were other people, however, who thought that Solomon was an idiot, that he was a fraud, an embarrassment, devoid of morality, and about to bring his kingdom to ruin. So which is it? Is he the greatest king that Israel ever had, or is he an idiot? Which one? Now, the biblical writers, there were a lot of people who helped write the Old Testament. They did it with the inspiration of God, but the biblical writers themselves are divided as to whether Solomon was an asset or a liability to God's work in this world. And so when we read the different passages of the Old Testament, sometimes Solomon comes across pretty good and sometimes not. There are a couple of books that are attributed to Solomon in the Old Testament, the Proverbs, and there's a romantic piece of poetry often referred to as the Song of Solomon. But on the other hand, there are passages in the Bible that, like what I read to you today, writing about how angry God was with Solomon and the choices that he made in his life. Now, I think the book of 1 Kings gives us as balanced of a view of Solomon as we're going to get. It tells us some things about Solomon that were positive, and it tells us some things about him that were negative as well. It's clear as we read through 1 Kings that Solomon was not a stupid person. He was a person who he knew that he didn't know everything, and so he diligently set out to learn as much as he could. And he learned from other people. He learned from any place where Solomon could pick up an education, could pick up knowledge. He did that. So, and he was a very, very intelligent person. He had a head full of knowledge. The fact that he was able to rule his kingdom for 40 years is evidence that he had to have something on the ball. His reign was well known as a time of peace and prosperity for Israel. We can read the history and see that Solomon was a skilled diplomat, and he made sure that he had good relationships with the nations around him, usually by marrying a king's daughter, but he had a way of knowing how to conduct international and foreign relationships. He was able to make sure that a great deal of wealth in the nations that surrounded him flowed into his country, to his house and his pocket, but he was able to pull that off. Solomon was the one who started and completed a number of building projects in Jerusalem and in the areas around it, Jerusalem, the capital city. It was Solomon who built the first temple. Solomon built a palace for himself and gardens and government buildings and walls. He fortified border cities. Solomon was the one who commissioned works of art, particularly literary works, some of which continue to bear his name to this day, like Proverbs and Song of Solomon. It was under Solomon that scribes began to write down the initial writings that would later become the Old Testament. It was those writings during his own reign that praise him and put the spin of how good he was. So Solomon had a number of accomplishments, and to be fair, those accomplishments should be recognized. But from the beginning of Solomon's kingship, He had made a covenant with God that he, on his part, failed to keep. And that's the key issue for the writer of 1 Kings. A covenant means that you have an agreement with somebody that they'll do things for you and you'll do things for them. So Solomon had this covenant with God, instigated by God, and God was going to do all sorts of wonderful things for Solomon. But the understanding is that Solomon would live up to his part of the covenant. Now, what is Solomon's end of the covenant that he failed on? Well, some of the things, they're pretty plain when we read through the Old Testament what Solomon was supposed to do. For instance, for his part of the covenant, he was supposed to have no other gods. That's the first commandment. No other gods before me, first commandment. That was Solomon's part of the covenant. God could give him riches and wealth and peace and stability and fame, but Solomon had his part of the covenant. Solomon's part of the covenant was to not make any or fashion any graven idols. That's the third commandment. That was Solomon's responsibility. Solomon's responsibility was to not murder anybody. The sixth commandment. Solomon's responsibility was not to commit adultery. The seventh commandment. Solomon's responsibility was to not covet what other people had. The tenth commandment. Solomon's responsibility was to remember the whole theme of the book of Exodus, that the people of Israel were a free people at great cost. God had delivered them from their slavery in Egypt. And if you were an Israelite, or if you joined the Israelites as a convert or as an immigrant, you were free. That was the basic definition of what it meant to be an Israelite. You were never again to be a slave, anybody's slave. That was Solomon's part of the covenant, was to remember that that's the essence of being an Israelite. Freedom, no slavery. It was Solomon's responsibility to remember the covenant that he was not supposed to become a burden on the people as a king. Now, in 1 Samuel, this is part of what had concerned God, is that if the people of Israel had a king, the king wouldn't be serving the people, but the king would somehow manage to flip that to where the people were serving him. And the people were working his fields, and the people were fighting his wars, and the people were putting food on his table. And so that was part of the covenant, is to not let it get to that point. If God's going to give you the kingship and the privileges that go with that, then you need to use that to serve the people and not have them serve you. Part of the covenant. Part of the covenant was to avoid fertility religions, foreign entanglements. Part of the covenant was to not forget that when you had good things in life, it wasn't because you were something special, it was because God is merciful. All of those are parts of the covenant. And those were all things that Solomon reneged on. Every one of them that I've just mentioned, he reneged on it. The first thing that he did when he became king was to have his brother Adonijah murdered. And then he had Adonijah's children murdered, and he had Adonijah's friends murdered. He murdered people that had offended his father David. He had all of them executed. He went on a murder spree when he first became king. He married 700 wives. He had 300 concubines. And worst of all, he enslaved his own people to build his palaces and do his work. He reneged on the covenant. He offended God in everything that God had done to bring the story to this point. Solomon had erotic idols fashioned, and he led the people in the worship of those false idols and false gods. It is very clear in black and white, verse 6, Solomon did in 1 Kings 11, verse 6, Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. In verse 9, the Lord was very angry with Solomon because Solomon had turned his heart away from the Lord, the God of Israel. Now, Solomon did manage to rule for 40 years. And the reason he was able to rule that long partly was because he did have some cleverness, but he was also able to rule that long because there was no internal dissent in the kingdom. He managed to kill everybody off during that time. It was a reign of terror. He also was able to rule for 40 years because, due to a strange blip in history, there really weren't any powerful foreign powers that were a threat to the nation of Israel. David, when he was king, also benefited from that blip in history. No problems from foreign interference. But even though he was able to rule for 40 years, by the time Solomon died, he had pretty well ruined the kingdom. He had pretty well destroyed it from within by oppressing his own people, separating his family and his followers from God, and he had lost touch with reality of the real world. And so when Solomon died, there was immediate civil war in the land. The 10 northern tribes split off, set up their own king by the name of Jeroboam. They called themselves Israel. The two tribes in the south had Solomon's son, Rehoboam, as their king. That included the capital city of Jerusalem. They called themselves Judah. And the north and the south were at war with each other for 50 years, and they were never again a unified Israel. Solomon's corrupt and foolish rule had destroyed the unified kingdom of Israel. Now, about 70, 75 years after Solomon's death, a king arose in the north from the Israel by the name of Ahab. And the scriptures tell us that Ahab was the worst. Several times the author of 1 Kings wants us to know that nobody was as bad as Ahab. 16th chapter, verse 30. Ahab did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. Now, Ahab, the Bible tells us, compounded the problem by marrying the most wicked woman in all of the Bible, Jezebel. A word about Jezebel. Most of what we have learned and been taught about Jezebel is a result of a long misogynistic vein in Judeo-Christian history. The fact is, Ahab is to blame for his own evil. He's to blame for his own stupidity. He's to blame for his own actions, not Jezebel. But Ahab is the primary figure in 1 Kings. Ahab had decided that he was going to get rid of the worship of God. He had decided he was going to get rid of anybody who was associated with God, and he was going to set up a new god instead, the god Baal. And it was decided by Ahab that everybody in the northern kingdom was going to worship Baal instead. So in order to deal with the with this problem, God sends a prophet by the name of Elijah. And Elijah, one of the most interesting characters in all of the Bible. He was tough. He was raw. We see his fears and anxieties, and we see his strengths and his wild side. A fascinating character in the Bible. So God raises up Elijah to deal with King Ahab. Now, the thing is, the god Baal was known in the region as the god of rain and thunder. So what better way to prove that the god of rain is a fraud and a fake than to have your god stop the rain? And so that's exactly what Elijah shows up and confronts Ahab with. He says, My God is going to bring a drought. There's going to be no rain for 3 years. And sure enough, there was no rain for 3 years. So he pretty well proved his point that this Baal, this God of rain and thunder, was a fake. it was a fraud. So for 3 years, there's no rain in the land. And there was a great famine, and there was great suffering, and there was death because of this. And you could imagine that one of the things that disturbed Ahab about all of this is that because of this drought, it caused his rule to become unstable politically. So he really wanted to get a hold of Elijah and put an end to this. But he couldn't find Elijah. Elijah had gone into hiding. He had hidden out at first near a wadi, one of those creek-like things that will dry up if there's not enough rain. So at first, Elijah was out there near in the wilderness, hiding in this wadi, and a raven would bring him food. But then what happened was that even the wadi dried up, and so Elijah had to wander off into a nearby country in order to find some place that had a well where he could get water. And he goes into the village of Zarephath, and he meets there a widow, and he asks her for some water from the well, and she gives him some water, and then he asks her for some bread. And she says, "I can't do that because I'm down to my last little bit of flour, and I'm down to the end of the oil, and I'm about ready to go home, and I'm going to bake a biscuit for my young son and myself, and after we eat that biscuit, that's it. It's going to be, there's no more food, there's nothing, and there'll be death after that." Elijah somehow had the audacity to say, "Well, why don't you make that biscuit and give it to me?" So I don't know why she did this, but she sensed something that this was a man of God, and so she went home and gave the last biscuit to Elijah. And a strange thing happened, because for the rest of that famine, her flour never ran out. Every day she had flour for the rest of that famine. And every day she had oil for the rest of that famine. A remarkable thing that happened to her. So eventually, after 3 years, Elijah decides at the word of God that the rains are going to come back. And so they do, and there's this huge downpour, and the land is restored. And then Elijah goes to Ahab and Jezebel, and he said, we need to have a contest. We need to have a showdown to see who the real God is here. Does Baal even exist? Does my God even exist? Let's have a showdown on. Let's set up something so we can determine this once and for all. And so it was decided that each side would have an altar, and each side would sacrifice a bull, and each side would be able to get the firewood gathered to have this burnt offering. But each side had to pray to its own god to provide the fire. So the priests of Baal went first, and they slaughtered the bull, and they built up the wood, and they began to pray to their god, Baal, to bring down fire. Well, he's a god of rain and thunder. You know, lightning bolt ought to be fine to start that fire. And so they prayed, and nothing happened. And they cried, and nothing happened. And they whipped themselves into a frenzy. They even slashed themselves to where blood spurted on the ground, and nothing happened. But when Elijah prayed to God for fire, immediately, the fire came in powerful and glorious manifestation. It was very clear that there was no Baal other than in people's imaginations. But God, we need to make room to deal with God. God is real. As we're moving through all of these books, we're asking a question: what's the good news in the book? What's the bad news? What are the practical applications? The bad news, I think, in 1 Kings, as I've read it through this time, it seems to me as I'm reading through 1 Kings that the bad news is that too many privileges in this life tend to cloud people's thinking. Too many privileges in this life tend to cloud people's thinking. As we read through the book of 1 Kings, we keep being reminded of Deuteronomy. The two books are linked very closely together, Deuteronomy and 1 Kings. And Deuteronomy has this passage, you know, where Moses is about ready to die, and Moses is talking to the people. And he says, now when you get to the promised land, when you get to the land of milk and honey, I just want to warn you about one thing. When you get there and you have your privileges and you're living the good life, don't forget that it wasn't because you're something that you've got this good life. Don't forget it was God, and it was God's mercy. It was God who found you when you were a nobody and gave you everything that you have. And that was the message of Moses. It was the most powerful message in Deuteronomy that Moses gave the people. Don't forget that when life gets good and when you get your privileges and when things are going good, don't forget that it all comes from God. But too many privileges in this life, we see it over and over again in the biblical stories, too many privileges in this life tend to cloud people's thinking. Now, when we think of privilege, we think of kings and queens. And in 1 Kings, there are more than 15 kings that appear in the story, and every one of them allows the privileges and the power to go to his head, and every one of them suffers a fall because of that. Too many privileges in this life cloud our thinking. As I'm reading through the book of 1 Kings, it occurs to me that we don't have to be a king or a queen in order to have privileges and in order to be vulnerable to having our thinking clouded. As I've been reading through these kings that are listed in the Bible, I've thought to myself, I would not personally trade place with any of them. I don't want to trade places even with King Solomon. Because as an American living in the 21st century, my privileges far outweigh anything any of these kings had at that time. Even the pampered King Solomon. I have the privilege of living in a free country. I have the privilege of being able to take out my smartphone and talk with my grandchildren in another state, face to face, on FaceTime. I have the privilege of turning on the internet and reading about news anywhere in the world. I have the privilege of instantly communicating with anybody if you'll answer your phone, or if you'll answer your text messages, or you'll answer your email. The privileges of communication, Solomon never had that. I had the privilege of being woken up in the middle of the night by Randy sending me a text from Ireland. He should have remembered the time differences there. So Solomon never had that privilege to be woke up in the middle of the night by Randy. I can hop in my car and I can drive anywhere in North America. I can get on a plane and fly anywhere in the world. Solomon could not do that. I have the privileges of health care that he never had. Entertainment, education, music, art, nature, drama. The privileges of the Christian faith. Solomon never had that. Everything that I have, so many privileges that are just part of a routine for me, and the kings here had none of them. I may not have Solomon's gold, but even with a modest income, I have access to food and gadgets that he could never imagine. Now, I can read in the book of 1 Kings, and I can see how privileged they were and how their privileges clouded their judgment. Can I see how my privileges cloud my thinking? And the number one thing that happens when privileges begin to cloud our thinking is that we don't see injustices that are all around us. That's a clear message from the Bible. Privileges cloud our thinking. We don't see the injustices that are happening to our neighbors. And we'll talk about that more when we get to some of these later books of the Old Testament. But that's the bad news of 1 Kings. Privileges do cloud our thinking. The good news of 1 Kings is this, that every time our thinking starts to go off, God sends someone to remind us of the truth. I was surprised as I read through the book of 1 Kings how often a prophet keeps showing up. The book of 1 Kings starts with the prophet Nathan, and it includes other prophets as well. Of course, the main prophet in 1 Kings is Elijah, who shows up to help clarify clouded thinking. There are other prophets, some of them we have forgotten about, and we don't know their names as well. There's a fellow by the name of Shemaiah. There's a fellow by the name of Ahijah. There are numerous nameless prophets who keep showing up in the book of 1 Kings. And the role of the prophet is to help us when we're not thinking clearly, when we have reneged on our part of the covenant with God, when we're not seeing the things that we need to see. That's the role of the prophet, is to bring us the message of God. And the prophets just keep coming all the way through the book of 1 Kings. And I think that's good news, that God is not going to leave us in our clouded thinking. God's not going to leave us without continually giving us messages. It's hard to say where the prophetic word will come from, but God will use anything and anybody to get a message across to us. We see that in 1 Kings. The practical takeaways of 1 Kings. Just three things, and I don't have time to expound on them. One of the good things about Solomon is Solomon decided that above everything else, he was going to seek wisdom first. Before he tried to get wealth, before he tried to get anything else, he was going to seek wisdom. And that's a good practical thing to remember. Because it doesn't matter what else we have in the way of health, in the way of belongings, in the way of relationships, in the way of position that we might have in this life. None of that really matters if we don't have wisdom. And so this is what Solomon asked for. There's a king later on in near the end of the book of 1 Kings, and he was getting ready to try to decide whether he was going to go to war or not. And his advisors say, you need to check with the prophet. You need to check with the wisdom. And the king says, I hate that guy because he never tells me what I want to hear. But that's wisdom, is the ability, even if we don't want to hear it, to be open to what's being said to us. Seeking wisdom, first practical advice from 1 Kings. Second thing, practical bit of help from 1 Kings is that our personal selfish stories are always part of a bigger story. And if we lose sight of the bigger story, we're going to be in trouble. Yeah, we have our own lives, and most of the time we think about ourselves and we think about the people that are in and out of our lives and how we're connected and how it affects us and so forth. But if we forget the bigger story, this is what we see happening in Kings. These kings, they just got so caught up in themselves and their families and their lives that they lost sight of the bigger story, that they were a part of the people of God. And that story went back centuries, and it was going to go forward for centuries. When we good piece of practical advice, not lose sense, the sense of the big story. And then the third piece of practical advice, it's important for us to know when it's time for us to grab a hold of a new trapeze. And I'm thinking of the widow of Zarephath about this. She, you know, the trapeze in the circus, there comes a point, I mean, you can swing so long on a trapeze, and then it's time, you know, to look for the other trapeze and know when to jump and get a hold and start riding the new one. That's exactly what that widow that we talked about, who was down to her last biscuit. Somehow she knew that it was time to get off of that trapeze and grab a hold of a new one. That trapeze that she was on wasn't going to go. It was about to stop, and she would have just been left there with nothing, going nowhere. End of the story. But somehow she was able to sense when it was time to change the trapeze, to jump to something new. And when Elijah came along, she took that risk. She let go of that flour. She let go of that oil. And she grabbed a hold of a new possibility that was going to bring her life. That's a great story that has practical application in our lives, to know when it's time to let go of something that we've been hanging on to that's just about out of life, and when it's time to grab a hold of what God offers us. So the book of 1 Kings, next week we'll take up 2 Kings. The story will go on, but there will be some new and fascinating characters come our way with some new wisdom and new practical advice for us.